Now, there are certain things I expect that as parents you have certain expectations of your kids that they must do, like, for example, attend school. I presume you all expect your kids to attend school. So if they were to start to not attend school, that would be a compliance issue for you, right? They are breaking a rule that you have in your house for performance of your children. So not every issue where kids aren't doing what we want them to do is a matter of motivation. What prompted me to write this little book was I did a lot of work in the Indianapolis area with parents of kids who were intelligent, had seemingly every conceivable attribute that was necessary for success in school, and the kids weren't succeeding at all. And all of the efforts that parents made, no matter how well-intentioned they were, no matter how reasonable or sensible they were, didn't make any difference. And in my experience, the efforts fell into two categories. And one category is some kind of incentive or punishment. So it'd be some kind of externally applied consequence, right? Do this and you'll earn this. Don't do this and you will receive this unpleasant consequence. And the second category, and parents usually pulled from both of these categories, by the way. But the second category was talk, and when that didn't work, more talk, right? Of the type that you are very familiar with, right? So a lot of lectures and a lot of sermons and a lot of scoldings and a lot of fear-inducing and a lot of talk about flipping burgers and all that kind of stuff. In an attempt to try to get them to all of a sudden say, gosh, Mom, you know, you're right. I've never seen it from your point of view before, but that makes a ton of sense. I'm now going to start doing my homework.
Yeah. Never said it.
Never happens, right?
Never
has happened in the history of Western civilization. Never will happen. So those are the two things that parents typically do. And I, once again, I'm not saying they don't make sense. And I've worked with millions of parents in the course of my long career who have done very sensible things, and the only grounds upon which their efforts could be criticized, if they could be criticized at all, is that they didn't produce the result the parents wanted, number one. Number two, what happens, and I've seen this a blue million times in my career, the relationship between the parent and the child becomes contaminated by all things school-related.
Oh, can you just say that again?
Right? The relationship between the parent and the child becomes contaminated by everything that's related to school. So the evenings can revolve around homework and homework completion and argument about homework and then checking out PowerSchool or whatever particular computer program your school district has where you can watch, you can follow every jot and tittle of your child's performance in school. And when that child comes home, you can grill him or her about why did you not turn in your assignment in health class today, right? And then that starts a whole cascade of unpleasantness that can take care of the entire evening. And I know parents and kids whose relationship is entirely marked by things that have to do with school, period. And it's always unpleasant. And that may describe some of you in the room, I don't know, but
told them not to get on PowerSchool. They've been warned.
Exactly. And I tell parents, and they very often think I'm wrong, but I think PowerSchool is one of the worst involvements that's been developed because, you know, as a kid, you can't even bomb a pop quiz and then recover on your own. Because then if you bomb a pop quiz, your parents see it, they climb your case, they ground you. You do better, then the parent thinks, oh, my gosh, my efforts are what made the difference, right? Coming down really hard on my kid is what made the difference, and then that gets repeated. And when that happens week after week, month after month, over the course of some years, it really becomes unpleasant for you and your child, okay? And somehow people my age got through school very successfully without anything of that nature. And, you know, I like to tell a little example. This is an anecdotal thing, but I have three siblings. We were all good students. My parents never asked us about school. Never. How was school? Do you like school? They didn't care if we liked school. It didn't make any difference then whether we liked school. Right? As long as we were doing what we were supposed to be doing. If they got a report that we weren't up to snuff, they would do something about it. Otherwise, nothing. And you know, we were all good students, and I can remember my father would come home, see our grade cards, look at them, and they were filled with A's and B's, my siblings and me. And my dad would just say, not mean, he'd just say, gee, just once I wish somebody would come home with all A's, and he'd walk away, and that was it. Right? No support, no encouragement, but an expectation that when you're at school, you're supposed to do what you're supposed to do. So this notion that there has to be this parental involvement in academics is a relatively historically new one, and I don't think it necessarily serves the kids very well. And one of the challenges of kids everywhere is learning how to function independent of you folks, right? So, you know, when I think of raising children, let me back up. When I think of any project, and raising a child is a project, is it not? Then you're not going to have a successful effort unless you have a sense of what your goal is. And we don't think so much in terms of goals when raising our kids. But what I like to suggest is that the goal that we have when it comes to raising children is to eventually turn out into the world a self-sufficient child who can stand on their own two feet and is full of character. That's our job as a parent, right? If you do that and your children hate your guts, you've done your job. True or true?
No. We don't want them to hate us.
Right. But what I have found historically is that if you keep your focus on kids doing what they're supposed to be doing and having some degree of self-sufficiency, et cetera, not only will they be that, but you'll also have a pretty good relationship with them. And the more you worry about your relationship with your child, typically the worse it is. Another paradox of raising kids, right? The more you worry about whether your kids feel good about you. I never cared what my kids thought about me. I didn't care about that. My father didn't care what I thought about him. That wasn't the nature of the relationship. Okay? So if you think in terms of that goal, that can define a lot of what you do. Let me ask you a question. There are, what, maybe 10 of you in the room this morning.
Oh, right? There's more than that. We're packing it.
Oh, there are people I can't see.
This is just what you can see.
So you were the unlucky ones that are in front of the camera. So let me ask you this question. And I don't know how old your children are. I know nothing of that. But by show of hands, and don't look around, how many of you moms take responsibility in the morning for seeing to it that your children get up and out of bed?
I have one.
All right. So I would ask you this question without wanting to call anybody out. Why do you do that? The single most fundamental thing any person has to do during the course of a day to be at all responsible and self-reliant is to get themselves out of bed, right? Yet, as mothers, you're taking the responsibility for that most fundamental thing from your child. So I've worked with parents over the years who have hellacious fights in the morning with their children about getting out of bed. And every morning starts out unpleasantly because there is this involvement. What should be a one-person activity is at least a two-person activity, and it's unpleasant. So if they would take that responsibility on their own, you could read the paper, you could watch a Today Show, you could have an extra cup of coffee, whatever you want to do in the morning, and not fight with your child about making the bus on.
So at what age do you recommend starting that?
I'm sorry?
What age would you start that, getting up on their own?
You know what's great? Little kids tend to get up early, right? Little kids get up early and teenagers sleep late, and there are biological explanations for that we won't go into, but I would say as soon as the kids start school in kindergarten, you know, here's your alarm clock, here's how it works. Kids will be intrigued by that, right? They'll be very interested in that, and they may wake up before they need to anyway because they're 5 years old, right? But then you have set that pattern, and it doesn't become something you have to break some years later. So I think as soon as kids are going to school, you do that. The more kids can do for themselves, the better favor you're doing, that you're doing your children. And one of the problems I think with modern motherhood that you folks are sort of saddled with is this notion that the measure of my worth as a mother or my devotion to my children is how much I do for them. And when you sort of back off and expect your kids, like if you would expect your kids to make their own breakfast before school, some mothers would think you were a terrible mom. But what a great thing that would be for a kid to get up and make their own breakfast, wouldn't it? And some of your kids do that. And it's also okay for you to make their breakfast. I'm not saying you never do anything for your children. That's not my point. But if you start to think about this notion of self-reliance, and it's not only self-reliance, because we also have to know how to work together with others and accept help from others, certainly. But this notion of self-reliance is really very powerful.
And I know that's why I think we have the anxiety and depression that we do, is they're not doing as much for themselves. But can you talk about how you would transition from we wake them up to, like, what would that transition look like?
Yeah, I would just say, and first of all, I would say that if there is some kind of chronological marker, like the start of school or a birthday or the beginning of second semester or whatever, you can say, hey, now that you're six, or now that you're seven, or now that you're 17, whatever it happens to be, you're going to start getting yourself in the morning. I'm not going to get you up. And your child may not believe when you say that. When you make a left turn or, you know, a full 180, very often your kids don't believe that you're going to do what you say, right? And so I think you just kind of announce it. There's no way to make it easy. It's going to go from not happening to happening, and you can't ease into that. So I think you just make the announcement, this is how we're going to do things from now on. And then you will be downstairs biting your fingernails, wondering if they're getting themselves ready for school or not.
So what happens when they miss the bus?
You let them be late and show it. A big deal.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, you say would I allow the child to be late, did you say?
Yes, for sure.
Well, yeah.
Yeah, once, a couple times, you know. I mean, kind of have kids really don't want to be late for school. There might be an occasional exception to what I just said. But kids don't want to be late for school. They want to be at school and be there on time and be there with their friends and not be weird and not be different. So I think if you just announce it as an expectation, and what a lot of parents will do is they'll state their expectation and then they add to the end of their expectation the following two-syllable word, okay, right? So tomorrow you're going to get yourself up and ready for school and I'm not going to be involved in that process, okay? And that's a permission-seeking statement that you're making to your child, right? But if as a parent you just say, as the executive in your household, you just say, this is how we're going to do things here on out. And I don't imagine they enjoy being awakened by you, do they?
No.
Probably not. And it usually goes something like this. Good morning, honey. It's time to get up. Honey, it's time to get up. No good morning. Get up. Get up. Hey, it's getting late. Get up. There's that stair step escalation. And parents do the same thing morning after morning after morning after morning. I'm going to tell you a real quick story, if I may, about this. I had a mother consult me one time about this very problem. Her son was a senior in high school. She was getting him up in the morning. It was a pitch battle every morning to get him out of bed and get him on the bus to go to school in the morning. So short and long story, I gave her the following assignment. I said, I'd like you to, starting tomorrow morning, announce to your child you're not going to get him up. And what is the latest he can get up and still get the bus on time? And she said 7 o'clock. Now, what time do you start getting him up? 6 o'clock. So there was this hour-long battle every morning she had with her son, right? This may be familiar to some of you. And so I said, here's what I want you to do. Do not go in at 6 o'clock or 6:15 or 6:30 to wake him up. Have an extra cup of coffee, relax, read the paper. And if he's not up by 7, what I'd like you to do is go get him up. But I'm going to give you 3 conditions. Okay? I want you to get him up without saying a word. I want you to get up in a way that is no fun for him. And I want you to get him up in a way that is a lot of fun for you. Okay? And I think the third variable is the one that really caught her diabolical. Okay? So to shorten the long story, the next morning he, of course, didn't get up. And as she tells me when I next met with her, she crawls into his bedroom on her belly like a commando. She has between her teeth a pair of tweezers. She pulls up the covers at the foot of her son's bed and he yanks hairs out of his lower leg. He sits bolt upright in bed and says, what are you doing? And she says, good morning, dear. It's time for school. And leaves the room. Right? The next morning, she does the same thing. She pulls back the covers. He sits bolt upright in bed and says, don't you dare, and gets out of bed. The next few mornings, he gets out of bed on his own. She thinks she's got it solved. The eventual morning came where he didn't get up. She repeats this process. She pulls back the covers. He sits up in bed. He's totally dressed, ready for school, and he's just playing a trick on
her. Yeah.
So it went from this hour-long battle in the morning over the course of a couple of weeks to some playfulness on the part of her son. I'm not recommending that as a one-size-fits-all approach for that. That's not my point. My point is she did something very different from what she had normally done. And if I were limited to one piece of advice to give parents, if I could only tell them one thing, it would be this. Save your breath. Talk, right? And your kids may do an impression of someone who's paying attention to you. Well, they're probably not, right? So act, don't talk, whatever that means in any given circumstance.
Okay, can we go back to the motivation? Because you built out, hey, punishments and rewards. We're not doing that. We're not lecturing, talk. So start us over again. Because I love the way you did it in the $24 book, that maybe you could offer us a deal on it, because it is one of the best things I've ever heard.
All right. So,
how big is the group?
It's a big group.
It's kind of important to take a look at motivation and what really goes into it. And, you know, it's my business to understand this. It's not your business. I mean, I'm a psychotherapist. I presume you folks aren't. So, you know, you take a look at it, and a lot of people have misunderstandings about it. So it's not encouragement necessarily. And some people have been motivated by encouragement, absolutely. And I'm not talking about you being discouraging to your children. But number one, I like to talk about parents, is motivation is not rah-rah. All right? It's not getting behind somebody with a ton of enthusiasm, you know, I know you can do it kind of thing. And one of the things that we know is that if you get very encouraging with people who aren't doing what they're supposed to be doing or aren't making the grade, number one, it tends to be demotivating as opposed to motivating. And number two, what happens is the kids feel guilty then because they're not meeting that standard. So as a result of your very well-intentioned efforts, you've got a demotivated child who now feels guilty. Congratulations, right? So what we really want to do is spend some time getting behind what's going on with kids. So let's say your child's struggling with math, and you say, what's going on in math? And he says, my teacher hates me, right? Most every parent would say something like this. Your teacher doesn't hate you. If you would just do your work, your teacher would think much better of you, right? Or something along that line, right? But if you take the time and say, gosh, what's going on that makes you think your teacher hates you? Right? And that's a very carefully worded sentence. You're not agreeing that the teacher hates him. But what makes you think your teacher hates you? And then have the child spend some time talking with you about that. So as parents, we tend to kind of jump down on the side of, oh, that can't be the case, or if you would just knuckle down, there wouldn't be a problem. But I want to spend some time just kind of being with you where you are with that thought. Even if we think it's not founded in reality necessarily, tell me more about that. So if your child is struggling at the table with their math homework, and all of a sudden you see them get very frustrated, crumple up their paper, throw it across the room and say, I'm so stupid. You walk over as a mom, and what do you say, Mom? You're not stupid, right? You're not stupid. And right away, what you've done, with the best intentions, I want to say once again, what you've done is you've shut down the communication process because your child feels stupid right now. So the response to that is, oh my gosh, what has you thinking you're stupid at this moment? And let them talk about it. And the ideal outcome, which doesn't always happen because it's ideal, is the child says, well, I guess I'm not stupid, but I really have trouble with math. Okay, join the club. No problem there, right? So, and, you know, we see this in little ways. If you're walking with your two-year-old down the sidewalk and your two-year-old trips and falls and skins her knee, what do you do? Come on, Mom, it's not a hard question. You rush over, you pick them up, are you okay, right? But the thing to do really, which would make me look like you, like make you look like a really bad mom in the north side of Indianapolis, Indiana, is you let them sort of gather themselves. And if the child falls down and skins their knee, they take that, there's that 3-second process where they take inventory, right? Oh my gosh, I fell down. That was unpleasant. How am I? Am I okay? Am I bleeding? Have I broken anything? Oh, I look like I'm all right. And then they move on. And that's a really powerful, although small, lesson in sort of self-reliance. But if we rush in before they have a chance to do that, we've taken away that opportunity for them to do that. Okay. So if we just kind of spend some time with them where they are, right? So I tell a story in the book about this client I had. He was a junior in high school. Smart kid. He had a 1.8 GPA. His parents were beside themselves with frustration. They had punished every way they knew how. They had rewarded every way they knew how. They had said every motivational thing they could think of to say. Nothing made a difference. And I sit down with this kid and I say, gosh, do you want to graduate from high school? And he looks at me like I'm crazy. What are you talking about? So I don't know. I'm just kind of curious. Do you want to graduate from high school? You've got a 1.8 GPA, which is a D plus, right? And I don't know if you're going to get better or worse over the rest of your high school career. Do you want to? Of course, I want to graduate. Now he's making the argument for doing better, not me, right? Not his parents. And I said, what are your plans for the future? He said, well, I want to go to college. And I just played dumb with him, right? So it's been a long time since I've gone to college. Can you get into college with a 1.8 GPA? And I'm pretty sure the answer is no, but, well. And then what are your hopes for your career? I want to be an anesthesiologist. And I said, I don't want you to be my anesthesiologist. I don't want an anesthesiologist with a 1.8 GPA. I want one with a 4.3 on a 4-point scale. That's who I want to sleep on the table, right? But we just began this long conversation about what he wanted, and me with him gently and respectfully drawing the difference between what he said he wanted and what he was really doing. So if I say to you, sitting here now, I want to lose 5 pounds, and as I say that, I'm scooping ice cream out of a gallon bucket into my mouth. Do I want to lose 5 pounds? I do if the loss of 5 pounds falls out of the sky into my lap. Right? But if I have to do something about it, like give up my ice cream, maybe I don't want to lose 5 pounds. And those are very important questions for me to ask myself. Do I want to go to college? Yes or no? If I do, am I on track to do that right now? And that's a conversation to be had, not a lecture to be given. You're never going to get into college with these kind of grades, with blah, blah, blah. That demotivates children. And so when I say to kids sometimes, gosh, maybe you don't want to go to college, their reaction is not usually, yeah, you know, you're right. Their reaction is usually, what are you talking about? Mm-hmm. And I say to them, what I'm talking about is the evidence in front of me. You with me? So it's more trying to find out where they are. And as parents, we don't always take a lot of time with that. We sort of launch into our sense of where they need to be. And if that worked, we wouldn't be talking this morning. Okay. So that's number one. It's not rah-rah. Number two that's important to know, and this comes from the research on motivation, is that we tend to think of motivation as an individual characteristic. This person's highly motivated, or that person lacks motivation. But what we know now from the research on this is that motivation is actually a function of a relationship. It's not an individual trait. So I happen to be fortunate enough in my life to have a number of motivating relationships that helps me get things done. And when you look at people who have been successful in life, they tend to have been involved with other people who have helped them in that effort. They haven't. There are certain examples of people by sheer force of will have motivated themselves to do something, but they tend to be rare. Okay, so the question for you is not, is my son motivated, or why isn't my daughter motivated? The question is, might I find myself having a motivated relationship with these children of mine? And then how do I get there? One of the things is you begin by trying to understand what their position is and not fighting them on their position, just understanding what it is. So your math teacher hates you. Tell me more about that. It's been way too long answering that question, but that's...
We have another question.
We've got a question. Hang on, Amy.
Yeah.
What if they're too young? Can he hear me?
What if they're too young?
What if they're too young to understand what they're feeling, why they're feeling it, or able to verbalize it?
They just know they don't want to do what they're being asked to do at school.
Or at home.
Or at home.
I'll say, so you mean like, so you've got like an 18-month-old child?
No.
That's not motivated?
Like a kindergartner or first grade?
Kindergartner first.
Well, I'm not, I would begin, I guess, by sort of challenging the premise of your question, because I'm not sure that they don't know or they can't say. They may not want to say, or we may not be approaching it from the right direction. So I'm not going to automatically say they're not verbally ready to do that to begin with, number one. Number two, and one of the notions that also is fundamental, I'm trying to answer your question, so bear with me, that's fundamental to the notion of motivation is that we tend to have this sense, and we see it in the way we talk about it, that motivation precedes performance, right? When I get motivated, I will do X. We've all said something like that. When I get motivated, I'm going to start going to the gym. When I get motivated, I'm going to clean the attic. Whatever, okay? My question is, how do you get motivated to do those things?
You do them. I already told them. I read it.
All right. So what you do is you knock over the first domino somehow, right? Or with your child who is 5 or 6 years old, you don't necessarily engage in a deep, meaningful conversation about what's going on with them, but you somehow find a way to knock over that first domino. So they start to do something, and they may see the value in it. We have all done this. So you don't get motivated and then do something. You do something, and then you get motivated. So very often our challenge is to get kids to start doing something. With the 5 or 6-year-old, there are probably a number of ways you may be able to start something for them so that they can see the value in that. And I'm not going to say that they're going to say to you, hey, Mom, now I see the value in, you know, learning my numbers. That's not the point. But they will do it essentially on their own. But I don't know that I'd worry a ton about a kid that young yet who was seemingly not motivated. But if you have that worry, I think what I would do is, again, try to start some behavior in the direction of your goal, however it is you get that started.
Well, if it's they're having an emotionally hard year at school and don't like school because they're unhappy, they don't want to be motivated. So it's like it's attached to emotional, you know, whatever.
Right. So at the risk of sounding really, really cold once again, I don't care whether kids like school. I mean, obviously it's better if they do, right? I mean, clearly we're going to be more productive if you like what we're doing, but the issue is not, do you like it? The issue is, are you doing what you're supposed to be doing there? Whatever that is, depending on, age, developmentally appropriate stuff. But I'm just going to quietly, you know, my wife was a school teacher. She's retired now. And our son, when he was 7 or 8, didn't like school. And my wife would say to me, what are we going to do? John doesn't like school. I said, here's what we're going to do. We're going to send him every day. And we're going to expect that he does what the teachers expect of him. That's what we're going to do. And whether he likes school or not is up to him. I really don't care. Now, in an ideal world, I would wish he would like school, but I'm not going to waste any energy over the notion that my son doesn't care for school. That's his choice, not mine. What a bad dad, huh?
It all turned
out,
right?
What a cold, uncaring, unfeeling father. So that, I think, has been one of the shifts in child rearing that I have certainly seen over the course of my life, is that there's been a lot more focus on kids' feeling state. And I'm not saying that's all bad. A lot of that is very good. But sometimes it comes at the expense of simple performance. Are they doing what they need to be doing? And one of the great lessons for kids to learn is how to do stuff you don't like. How much time do you spend doing stuff you don't like? a lot. Mm-hmm. Right? There's a concept that's getting a lot of play right now in certain signals, and that's the concept of signaling. Signaling. And if you get out of college, if you're able to graduate from college, let's say, and you're talking to a potential employer, the employer is not so concerned necessarily with what you learned when you were in college, but the fact that you have a college degree signals to the potential employer that you know how to do a bunch of boring stuff you don't care at all about. And that's a very valuable skill to have in many jobs, right? Unfortunately for some people. So what I'm interested in is that kids know how to do that. So when my kids say, I really hate this class, or junior in high school, I hate English, I say good. Because I'm a bad dad. I say good. This is going to be an experience for you to spend an entire year doing something you don't like and finding out that you can do okay at it nonetheless.
Mm-hmm. And that's the motivation. One of my favorite parts of the book was how you ended it, where you said, and it's just a short little pamphlet that we could get a deal on if we just keep talking about the good deal. But what I really liked was at the end you said, if all else fails, and I think you walked through systematically really well, you said if all else fails and there's your kid not wanting to do his homework, you said, have him come up on the couch with you and watch a movie, and just to maintain that relationship. So I just, if you want to talk more about that, and then we can go to the self-esteem stuff. But
yeah, I would say one of the things I see is kids who are doing poorly in school, and as I sort of touched on earlier, they have a crummy relationship with their parents because of it. So you have poor school performance, lousy relationship. I would prefer poor school performance, pleasant relationship. So if you have spent your entire, let's say at this point, 2.5, 3 years of your child's high school career, and you've been in this constant conflict over school-related things, and every evening you say to them, you have your homework done? Why aren't you doing your homework? Let me see your backpack. Open that up. How come you haven't done this yet? Go upstairs and get this done. We've got this nice desk upstairs. We've got this well-lighted study space for you.
We got some conviction going on here. Hang on.
There we go. All right. All right. Instead, you walk up to your child, and they're ready to hear that from you, and you say, hey, let's go get a milkshake. And they're like, what in the hell happened to mom? Who is this person, right? Who is this person? And because if unpleasantness, and you know, I say this, I think, very early on in the introduction of my book. As parents, we say, you know, if a million applications of this hasn't worked, I'm confident the 1,000,000th and the first one will get the job done, right? But it won't. So if my kid's going to struggle in school, then at least I can have a pleasant relationship with him. And maybe my kid, I think it's been a while since I read my book, but I think there's an example there of a kid who struggled. There'd been a kid who struggled, and then he decided he wanted to be a chef. And so he goes into culinary school, and it's a very hands-on, very active, it's right in his wheelhouse, and he graduates from Ivy Tech, I think, with a culinary associate's degree, I forget now the exact specifics, and he gets a job in a kitchen, and he loves it, and he's making a living, and then he goes from being a sous chef to being a chef. And it was right in his wheelhouse, but there was all this push about, you know, you got to get good SAT scores. You can get into a good college, blah, 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 right? And kids can feel really invalidated by parents who are always saying those kind of things.
Well,
I've got a friend who's got a construction company. He said, I could pay two plumbers right now $80,000 a year. I can't find a plumber. I've got openings for two. I can pay him $80,000 with benefits. I can't find any. Right? And what a satisfying job that can be, right?
No? Yeah.
Okay, go.
Well, let's segue, because I've already seen some transition to more the anxiety, depression. I know you speak a lot about that. And, you know, personally, I've got a 20-year-old that's suffering from the anxiety. He's one of the sensitive kids. I just think his nature is
right.
But I feel like it's pervasive in our society because of other things, that it's not just the sensitive kids that have their anxiety, it's the other kids too. So if you could just talk about, you know, what we can do to deal with that anxiety, depression.
Yeah, okay. And let's first of all distinguish the two, okay?
Yeah.
Anxiety from depression, because they're very different things, and a person can deal with both. And sometimes anxiety, the way it manifests itself in people, can lead to more depressive states, certainly, all right? But they are two very distinct things. So, and you're right, there are what are called HSPs, highly sensitive people.
Yeah,
and that's not a diagnosis, but that's just kind of a description. So if you look at the continuum, there are some people who are very, very sensitive, and some people who are not sensitive at all, and most of us fall somewhere in the middle of that continuum, right? But if you think about anxiety and what it is fear-based, okay? So if I'm walking down the street and somebody comes up to me and puts a gun in my ribs and says, give me all your money, I'm going to be afraid. And I'm going to have a whole cascade of physical symptoms that go along with that. My heart's going to start beating faster. I may begin to perspire. I'm going to start to hyperventilate, et cetera. Those are all very normal, built-in, age-old responses to fear. Okay, they make a lot of sense in that situation. Anxiety is when we have those same responses without the person with the gun. You with me? So you respond as though you're physically threatened, even though you're not. So the threat is a psychological threat. It's a threat to one's ego, not to one's physical safety. And there are people, little people, people our age, who deal with this a lot. So the first thing to know is that it's all about fear, and it's also all about the future. And that future can be 5 minutes away, and that future can be 5 months away. But anxiety happens when we project ourselves into an unpleasant, undesirable, unwanted future, no matter where that is, no matter how far down the road that is. Okay. So when I work with anxious people, and I happen to have a bunch on my caseload right now, a bunch of anxious teenagers. The first thing that I talk about is, and I use the same language with depression, but I don't say you have anxiety. I say you do anxiety. Mm-hmm. And if you do something, you can undo it, which is really encouraging to know, all right? So I think it's really important for kids to understand some of the basic fundamentals behind anxiety. Because if you have it, it can be amazingly bewildering, along with scary. It's like, what's going on with me now? What is happening here, right? And if you have an anxiety episode that is so severe that it bleeds into panic, you can feel as though you're dying, literally. And so I've had adults who've had panic attacks, who believed they were having a stroke or believed they were having a heart attack, and there was every reason to believe that, because that's how scary it is physically, as well as emotionally. Okay. So it's useful for people to understand that, number one. It's useful for people to understand that they're not going to suffer any physical harm. They're not going to have a heart attack. They're not going to have a stroke. They're not going to get an ulcer. Sometimes people feel they're going to pass out. That won't happen. They might think they'll vomit. I mean, that may have happened some very rare occasions, but it's very rare. Usually nothing happens physically, although it feels like it's going to. You're going to be okay, number one. Number two, so important, you have to function while you are anxious. If you wait for the anxiety to go away to function, it will not. So no client of mine has ever overcome their anxiety sitting in my office. They've overcome their anxiety by practicing some of the things that we talked about in my office out in the real world. Okay? I'm going to give you a personal example to make this point real quickly. One of the ways that I made my living over the course of the last 30, 40 years is giving presentations to larger groups of people. I enjoy doing that, and I'm pretty decent at it typically. When I went to college as an 18-year-old, this is beyond dispute what I'm going to tell you now. I was the most anxious, self-conscious, nervous, frightened college freshman ever to step foot on a college campus anywhere.
Indiana University. Woohoo!
I'm sorry?
Indiana University. Maybe that was your problem.
Am I talking to a Purdue grad?
No, I was just kidding. It's gotten real really trashy down there lately.
All right.
Go ahead.
And actually, I didn't start at IU. I finished at IU, but I didn't start there. So, one of the requirements, the grad requirements, when I went to school as a freshman was public speaking, and I was scheduled public speaking my very first semester. I was terrified. So I did exactly what I shouldn't do, which was I dropped the course my first semester of my freshman year so I could survive. And I said to myself, I'll take this class when I'm no longer afraid to speak in public. Mm-hmm. When was that going to happen?
Yeah, never.
Never, all right? But I had enough self-awareness to know that it wasn't going to happen. So what I did was I called the church that I was attending and I said, I want to be a reader. And then I lied to the church. And I said, I'm only available to read at 7 o'clock Mass in the morning. Why did I pick 7 o'clock in the morning? Nobody was there. They were all old people. Half of them were half asleep, right? So what I did was I got the readings, and I rehearsed, and I got up front, and I was frightened as hell, and I was able to read them. And I realized I was able to do this. And then I called the church and I lied again. And I said, gee, my schedule has changed. I'm now available for later masses. So then I would do like the 9:30 because there were more people there and they were more awake. And it was more threatening to me and more intimidating. But I taught myself that I was able to do it, right? And I did it while I was afraid. And if you had told me when I was 18 years old that one of the ways that I would make my living or a big part of my career would be public speaking, addressing large groups of people, I would have said there's absolutely no way that could possibly happen. So you do it while you're afraid. So if your kids are anxious about something, you don't take them to the doctor and start them on Xanax, right? You explain to them what anxiety is, the dynamics of it, in a way that I've sort of talked to you now real fundamentally, and we can do an hour sometime on anxiety if you want to, but you talk to them about that, and they have to know, Got to do it while you're anxious. I'll support you through this as best I can, but you can't wait till the anxiety goes away to do it because it never will. Take it from me. I've been in this business for a long time. I'm here to support you. You can get this done.
We've got an anxiety question. Go ahead.
Go.
From the big side of the room over there with the hundreds.
You can't see me, but how do you teach yourself to be not anxious about something you're anxious about or your teenager? Like, if they're anxious about something, how do they teach themselves not to be anxious about something?
Yeah, well, first of all, I think they hopefully have somebody to help them with that, right? But what I do then, and very good question, thank you, how I try to help people with it is I say, what will happen? Mm-hmm. So you're afraid of, I've got a student I'm working with right now, she's a senior in high school, she's got to take econ tests, and what she's been doing is skipping econ class, mm-hmm. not take the test. What'll happen if you take the test? I'll get a bad grade. Are you certain to get a bad grade, or is it likely you'll get a bad grade, or is there a chance you might not get a bad grade? And we walk through the reality of that, right? Let's say you get a bad grade, then what? Then I'll have a bad grade in econ. Okay, let's say I have a bad grade in econ, then what? So one of the things I like to do is walk people through this process I call and then what, and then what, and then what, right? And usually what they imagine is not that horrible. Nobody wants a bad grade in econ. We have all survived bad grades in something without the catastrophe that most people imagine. So it's usually the imagining of a catastrophe that produces the anxiety. Whatever it is, this will be awful. Sometimes people are clear about what they believe it'll be. Sometimes they have this very amorphous sense of, I don't know what it will be, but I won't be able to stand it. And if you can help them get detailed about that with what will happen, tell me specifically what will happen. And if they can be specific, then it's, what impact will that have on you? You know, I have a friend who told me some years ago, I've always remembered this, he said, he's older than me, and he said, I look back on my life, I don't regret anything that I did, but I regret a number of things I didn't do. And a lot of the things, he got me thinking about that with that statement, and a lot of the things that I didn't do because I was afraid. Not afraid for my physical safety, but, you know, I didn't try out for the school play because I thought I might not get the role and somebody would laugh at me or whatever, stuff like that, right? So if we can walk kids through that and support them through that, then they can learn to manage their anxiety. So if they do whatever episode it is and they're anxious as hell, but they come out the other side, we've helped them immensely.
I have a question. Culturally, it's gotten so drastic. And so my question is, it's people that now aren't the HSPs, the sensitive kids. I just feel like you've kind of hit on it with the little girl that falls and you rush to pick her up, where she loses that chance to address that she's just growing up more fearful. What other things are happening culturally that we can, you know, give our kids the best chance to not be, you know, anxious?
Well, I think that what we've done in our culture forever, and I think we're doing more of it now, is we are scaring people about things that are very unlikely to happen to them, and we're overlooking things that are much more likely to happen to them. So you remember, you're old enough to remember looking at you, I'm guessing, you know, when Columbine happened 20 years ago. That's been 20 years now, right? And everybody freaked out about school violence. And goodness knows there has been school violence since Columbine. I'm not trying to diminish that in any way. There has been. Right? But it's very unlikely that a child will be killed in school. Very unlikely. And I tell parents all the time, the most dangerous thing that your child can probably do every day is make a left-hand turn at an intersection. Right? So we overlook the stuff that is truly dangerous. And I'm not saying your kids shouldn't make a left-hand turn either. I'm not saying that. And we tend to amplify the stuff that's much less likely to happen. Number one. Number two, I'm old enough to remember, and I'm older than any of you in the room, but I'm old enough to remember when the evening news was 15 minutes long. And it was a series of announcements. The Labor Department reported today that the unemployment rate was 5.3%. In Europe, you know, whatever. And it was just announcements that it was done. Now, of course, we have 24-hour news. It has to be filled. And every blonde girl with a pretty smile who goes missing is on television 24/7, right? And I'm not saying those aren't tragedies. They are. I'm not trying to minimize the individual tragedy. But the fact that that'll happen to any given child is infinitesimally small. But we overlook that. So we tend to scare our kids about lots of things. I grew up, some of you perhaps grew up, with the notion that we could be incinerated at any moment in a nuclear exchange with the Soviet Union, right? There was a lot of anxiety involved in that, right? So part of what you've got to do, part of what I did, and everybody else may have did, is you have to deny that fact, otherwise you would go crazy. So you go about your life denying that, right? But there's a lot of stuff in the culture that's just out there to frighten kids. And here's an example. I haven't seen this for a long time. There used to be a bumper sticker that showed this really scary-looking guy with, like, a black hat on. He looked kind of like the devil. And it said, "Kids, don't talk to strangers." Isn't that a terrible piece of advice to give to a child? Kids, don't talk to strangers. Kids, don't go with strangers. Don't get into a car with a stranger. Don't accept something from a stranger. But don't talk to strangers? That's terrible advice. But we had that out there, right? Because strange people are scary is the message that we were being given. And now, I don't mean to be political anyway, but now on the national scene, we're getting that message. People different from us are people to fear. So now you talk about culturally, it's across the board we're hearing that. If people are different than us, you are to be afraid of them. Unknown Middle Easterners we need to be afraid of was the message we heard the other day. So there's a lot more out there, and we can help kids walk through that. How likely is this to happen of something that you may be afraid of? Not very likely.
We've got about five That's minutes left. Does anybody have something that you would...
What if you can't identify the anxiety, like where it's coming from?
Yeah, a lot of times it's just generalized.
You're physically feelings of anxiety, but you can't quite figure out what's...
The anxious feelings are triggered from potentially nothing. Just that you're in a state
overwhelmed,
of...
Yeah.
I'm going to say, although you haven't identified it, or maybe the child can't right away, I think with a little bit of conversation, it can be discovered. You know, some kids, for example, are simply, I'll say it this way, there are people who draw a ton of energy from being around people. They love to be around people. It's really hard for them to be alone, right? Then there are people like me who much prefer to be by themselves for the most part and enjoy small gatherings with people that I know and like a lot, right? Some kids are just anxious when they're put in situations where a lot of people are around because that is how they are wired, all right? And we don't have time to talk about today how to help them sort of walk through that kind of thing. But first of all, it's so important just to recognize a kid's disposition, right? Or a kid's temperament. I use those terms interchangeably. And some kids are wired temperamentally or dispositionally to be this direction. Some are wired to be more that direction. And sometimes we have to encourage them one way or the other, not change who they are, not invalidate the sense of who they are right now, but just encourage them to do other things and be there to support them through it. Maybe not at the moment, but before they do it and after they're done, and kind of do a debriefing with them and walk through it. And one of the things I like to say is, you survived, and you know what? The sun is going to come up in the east tomorrow morning because you've been, even though you've been through this. A lot of times kids will pick up their cues from us. Mm-hmm. How big a deal are we making of this? And if we might not be making a really big deal, you know, we spend a lot of time reassuring kids about something. They go, gosh, this must be a really bad thing because mom is really telling me, spent a lot of time telling me not to worry about it, right? But if we can take a more matter of fact, I did a lot of consulting with schools when I was in Indianapolis. And I guess they're still giving the I-step in Indiana, are they?
Yeah.
Not yet now.
I mean, next year it's going to be different.
Yeah.
All right, so they've given the I-step. And I would walk into the middle school, and there'd be big banners hanging up on above the hallways, right? And it would say, I step in 30 days, I step in 29 days, I step in, it was coming, right? And then when there were 2 days to go, it'd be like, make sure you get a good breakfast and get a good night's sleep. And so one of the things that we know is anxiety diminishes performance on cognitive tests, right? And so I would tell the school people, don't tell the kids about I-STEP. Spring it on them. Have them just show up one morning and say, oh, by the way, we're doing something different today. We're not going to have English. You're going to take this test. Because I imagine these kids lying in bed the night for I-STEP, you know, clutching the sheets, eyes wide open, frightful as hell because a life-determining test was going to be taken tomorrow. It's crazy what we do, right? Hey, kids, we're going to take a test. I think a lot of times the teachers were anxious because they felt their performance was measured by the I-STEP more than the children's, but that's a whole other issue. So anxiety diminishes performance, and sometimes we create that unintentionally, again, with the best intentions about what we say to kids.
Well, and because of social media, I think as parents, we are in this new culture, and TV shows that are the observational TV shows, whatever they're called, the
reality
TV shows, I think we feel like we're always on display, and our kids are on display, and we're the bad parent, and so when our kid falls, somehow that was our fault. So just in conclusion, can you kind of tell what you offer as far as services, and then who you would be recommending it that's still in Indianapolis if people wanted to meet with someone here?
Yeah, first of all, I would love to recommend somebody, but I can't bring anybody to mind. I'm sorry about that. That doesn't mean there aren't good people in Indianapolis. There are good people in Indianapolis, and you know, I'm at the age now where a lot of the people that I've known have retired or died. So
we like retired.
Absolutely. So I'll think about that. I know a lady because people move. I know a lady, and last I knew she was in Brownsburg, who I can recommend. She was good. But again, I'm thinking of my colleagues who have decided to not work any longer. So.
But if somebody would want
to contact me, you've got my contact info, Marianne, I think.
Yep. So how would it work with you as far as, you know, rates and all that? I mean, we're a money-conscious group here. Just tell us like it is.
No, I got you. Well, so my standard rate for an hour is $120.
Reasonable.
I don't do insurance. So if somebody wants to do insurance, then I will give you a bill. You can fight it out with your insurance company, and the fight is between you and the insurance company and not me and the insurance company. I'm too long in the tooth to have those kind of fights anymore. So I'm not going to do that. and I do Skype stuff. I do a lot of work with parents around these kinds of issues. I don't typically do what I would call therapy over Skype because I don't like not sitting in a room with people I do therapy with. Mm-hmm. But for parents that have some questions or concerns and want some consultation, I'm happy to do that. And all you got to do is contact me. And Marianne mentioned a deal on the book, so she's got my contact info. If you want to send me, an email, then I'll be delighted to sell you my book at half price.
Ooh, that's all we're looking for. That's all.
It's an e-book. It's
okay.
An e-book.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you're not gonna hold it in your hand unless you print it out, which you're quite welcome to do. But you can just shoot me an email. I'm on vacation for a few days, so I won't get back with you in any hurry. But I could get back with you sometime next week if you chose to do that. And you don't have to say I was part of this group. If you say give me the half price deal, I know you are part of the group. So easy enough. And then if there were a topic or concern that you might decide that I would be a useful person to address with down the road, feel free to contact me. I'd be happy to do this again with you sometime. It's easy for me. I'm not even wearing pants.
Neither are they. Neither are they. What would you look for if we were looking for a therapist in town? I mean, what are the kinds of things that you would be looking for? What I love about one of the things you offer is the brief therapy. And my husband does biblical counseling. He just loves to patch him up and send him back out there. So what would you be looking for?
Let me be clear. I practice what's called brief therapy, but I never set out to make it brief.
Mm-hmm.
But the way that I practice tends to make it brief. So what I mean by that is, if somebody comes to me, I'm more interested in solutions than problems. I'm more interested in the future than the past. And I'm more interested in strengths than weaknesses or deficits. Okay? So you come to me and you tell me what your concerns are and how you want to see things be different. And that's what we work on. And I don't bring up a bunch of stuff that you don't want to work on. Are you with me there? Some therapists will do that. So I use the example, if I go to the doctor because I have a sore throat and the doctor says, yeah, you're kind of ugly too, I would recommend some plastic surgery, I would say, unless my ugliness is connected to my sore throat, I just want you to fix my sore throat, all right? So I try to get very solution-oriented with my clients and focus on those solutions. We don't have to take care of everything in your life. We have to take care of whatever it was that you presented with. So I never say I'm only going to see you for a handful of visits, but the average number of time I meet with people is 4. And that includes the people I've seen once and the people I see 20 times. And I'll meet with people as long as they want to come in. So you drive the therapy, not me. I don't tell you what's wrong with you. I've never told anybody what's wrong with anybody. I don't tell you what you need to do. I don't know what anybody needs to do with their life, but we can work together to try to find a solution to whatever predicament you find yourself in.
Okay. All right. Well, we appreciate your time.
Thank you.
My pleasure. My pleasure.